y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s-loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This episode contains discussion of rape, murder via bludgeoning, kidnapping, fraud, BDSM, consensual and forced, mentions of suicide, mental and physical abuse, and general lying, sack of shit type behavior. Listener discretion is advised.
John Edward Robinson is a con man, grifter, embezzler, kidnapper, and murderer. For decades, Robinson ran schemes or flat out stole from his employers for monetary gain, but eventually escalated to murder. He would use classified ads to attract victims, but once the internet became commonplace in American homes, Robinson used it to find victims. Because of this, the media often refers to Robinson as the internet's first serial killer.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
Oh, geez.
Oh, crap.
So this is a part two. You may have already noticed that. If you've not listened to part one or watched it, probably best if you do that, because in that one, we do discuss the victims in like chronological order. We're going to go into what happened in those situations here, but we also went over his like early crimes and just all kinds of stuff. So probably better to start there if we were to make a suggestion.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, John Robinson is just known for fraud, theft, embezzlement from individuals, but also businesses. I mean, he really was an equal opportunity asshole.
Just a shit bag.
Yeah. One thing that there was not a lot of, though, is jail time. There was all kinds of probation, extended probation, more probation. Hey, have we thought about probation? Let's add some probation.
Super duper extended probation. Like,
yeah, incredible. Now, in today's episode, we're diving into everything else. So, in the summer of 1982, John Robinson had started a new consulting business, EquiPlus. He's real creative with all his like names too. There's like Equa, whatever, Equa Plus,
Equa Two.
Okay. Now, don't let this shock you to your core. I know this is going to be hard information to take in, but it was not a real consulting business. It was literally just to commit fraud and steal people's money.
Ugh.
I know you're shocked, and I don't mean to scare you, really. But during the summer, while trying to solicit his neighbors for money for this business, Robinson also constantly propositioned his neighbors' wives for sex.
Now, I understand what his goal was there, because clearly, but did he think that their wives weren't going to be like, hey, guess what John's doing?
Yeah.
Tell him to quit that.
Uh-huh. You might have one person maybe not want to make a big deal of it, you know, just because of like how we're kind of told to not make big deals out of stuff and like all that kind of stuff. But if you're going to go around to all of your neighbor's wives, one of them is going to tell their husband.
Or be like, I don't feel comfortable around John anymore, so I'm not going.
Exactly. And of course, this boiled over when one of his neighbors got pissed and attacked him. And so they had this like knockdown, drag out fight in their front yards. And of course, that's going to happen. And again, John Robinson is not like, oh, wow, I've just really got to like lock it up. Like, I've now ruined my relationship with every single one of my neighbors.
And this has got to be awkward at this point.
Yeah, because these guys are still going to see you like when you're out in your front yard mowing your grass or checking the mail or like whatever. Like, it's awkward, man. Sometime in the fall of 1982, Robinson started working with Irv Blatter, who knew about some of the scams that Robinson had pulled. His last name is spelled B-L-A-T-T-E-R. It sounds like your pee-pee bladder, but it's not. It's a different one. I just had to say that. So together, they started a sister company to EquiPlus and named it Equi2.
Where's the
That's what I don't. Yeah, what's why?
I don't know.
Like, I know that the Texas EquiSearch comes from like equine. The equine because he has horses and stuff. But yeah, I don't know what his big deal with Equi is.
I don't know.
So Blatter introduced Robinson to a woman who was looking into getting a divorce. So Robinson posed as an attorney, promising to get her a divorce. And as payment, he only asked for $200 and her car. No biggie. Just, I'm gonna need your car. So she gives both to him and then never hears from them again. She may still be married. I don't know. Like, in episode one, we mentioned Paula Godfrey. So Paula was 19 and wanted to begin a career in business.
Oh, wait.
And she was...
Sorry, this what? Just came to me. Equity? Equa?
Oh, maybe. If it's like business consulting. Yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. I'm so not good with big fancy schmancy business terms. If I was to create my own, it would be called conglomerate. And then the next one would be conglomerate too.
Exactly. Yeah. That is your favorite word, so that. Sure.
It's a good Sorry, word. I just, maybe equity, I don't know.
Yeah, that may be what it is. She was over the moon excited when she was offered a position at Equi2, and she had told her family that John Robinson was going to send her to San Antonio, Texas to take the course on clerical skills to prepare for this job. On September 1st, 1984, Robinson picked Paula up at her home in Overland Park, Kansas, to drive her to the airport for her flight to San Antonio. Some time passed. Paula's family had not heard from her, so they contacted the police. But shortly after that, they received a typed letter from Paula with her actual signature on the bottom. And the letter said, she's safe, but she has decided now she no longer wants any contact with her family. She's starting over on a new life and doesn't want to have anything to do with them. With that information and being unable to find any evidence of wrongdoing, the investigation into her disappearance was concluded with the belief that Paula left of her own free will. And like, of course that does happen, but it is strange that she's like, I'm just going out of town for a training thing and I will be back.
And then all of a sudden.
And then life will resume as normal. Yeah. And then it's like she goes to San Antonio and then she sends them a letter and says, actually, never mind. I just don't want to have anything to do with you guys anymore.
Now, I will say this, though, at least, and it's wrong. It's erroneous. But at least the police had some sort of something to back it up where they're like, well, I mean, the letter did come. It wasn't like, well, she probably just left mm-hmm. with nothing to go on, you know.
But wouldn't the police look at that and be like, that's kind of okay. It's weird that it's typed because we can't verify that it came from her. We can't, you know, like, is this even her handwriting? However, she's supposed to be in San Antonio for a clerical skills course. And now she's sending correspondence, which I would assume would be covered in this clerical skills course. I don't know. But it's just like, why would she choose to?
Why wouldn't
she wouldn't just jot it on a fucking postcard and be like, hey, guys, I changed my mind, like whatever. Right. I mean, you would think that if she's been reported as missing and the police see that the only contact that her family has had from her is a typed letter. It did have her signature on it.
But don't still. You think it's also kind of strange? Like if I was going to send you a letter, which I wouldn't because snail mail, gross. Although it is kind of fun to get mail that is not bills. But I wouldn't do it because we talk all the time and we text. But I sure as shit, if I was going to send you a letter, I wouldn't be like, best Victoria, like my entire full name. Like that just, that's weird.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And these things are signed as if they're signing legal documents, like first, middle, last name. It's very official. And yeah, if you're just sending a letter to one of your friends or your family members, you're not going to sign it like that. Like,
no.
I feel so like that formal. These are things that just, yeah, should have been red flags to the right. police, but because they were, it's not like the family was just like, I don't know, I haven't heard from her and I wonder what's happening. Like they reported this to the police. That's kind of like, they should know this.
Yeah. I think we've all been in a situation where something unexpected came up. You're just like coasting along, minding your own business, and bam, your check engine light comes on. And I know the song goes, this little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. But that light is not the one that they were talking about.
So true.
Right?
So true.
Well, if you've been in that boat before, Dave can get you cash when you need a hand between paychecks and can help you build credit by settling extra cash advances on time.
Dave is the banking app that's leveling the financial playing field. When you download Dave, you could get up to $500 in 5 minutes or less. No credit check, no late fees. It's part of Dave's extra cash account. Advance the money you need with no interest and then settle up later. And you can even build credit when you settle up on time. Millions of people have already downloaded the Dave app to make their finances easier. So if you're in a pinch, get the help you need by downloading Dave.
Download Dave today at dave.com/queens. That's dave.com/queens. You could get up to $500 in 5 minutes or less. No credit check, no late fees. Download the Dave app now or go to dave.com/queens. For terms and conditions, go to dave.com/legal. Eligibility criteria and instant transfer fees apply. Banking services provided by Evolve. Member FDIC.
In 1985, Robinson used the alias John Osborne and met 19-year-old Lisa Stassi through Hope House, a shelter for women experiencing homelessness in Kansas. Lisa had an infant daughter, Tiffany, and he claimed to be a member of the Kansas City Outreach Program. So Robinson told Lisa that the program was for young single mothers. Through the program, she would be trained in Texas to operate a silkscreen printer. This is so very specific. Like,
and it's
the first one was like kind of generic with just like clerical skills.
But also it's always Texas too, which why?
It is. Yeah, it's always Texas. So it's just kind of weird where he's like, your job is going to be to operate a silkscreen printer. And we're going to go train you specifically for that. Like, that's just like, I don't know. He's just pulling stuff out of his ass. Then she would be relocated to Chicago, where she would be placed into a job. She'd receive an $800 monthly stipend. She'd have childcare covered for Tiffany, and her apartment would be paid for as well.
All that is sus AF.
Yeah. And the only thing she had to do to receive all of these things was sign her name to the bottom of some blank sheets of paper.
Can't stress it enough. Said it in episode one, but I'm going to say it again. If ever someone asks you to sign blank sheets of paper at the bottom, run far, far away.
Yes, absolutely. There is literally not one thing that I can think of that somebody who has your best interest at heart would need you to sign a bunch of blank papers for.
And you have no control or knowledge of what is going to be typed or written on top of that paper. So,
Yeah, exactly. Lisa and Tiffany checked into a room at the Roadway Inn in Overland Park, Kansas. The room had been booked by Robinson and paid for with a credit card in the name of Equa 2. After checking in, Robinson told Lisa that he had arranged for her and Tiffany to travel to Chicago in a couple of days. Over the next day or two, Lisa took Tiffany to a family member's house where her family tried to talk her out of going. When they questioned her about Robinson, she told him he was a gentleman and he was just helping her. Robinson didn't know where Lisa was, but eventually he found her at her sister-in-law Kathy's house. In a heavy snowstorm, Robinson drives to pick her up at Kathy's house, and he is pissed that she had the audacity to leave that motel. And he told her, well, now we have to leave immediately or they're going to rescind this offer to give you this job because you've left the motel for a short period of time. That just...
None of that. It's all fishy. It's all yuck.
Yeah. So Lisa took Tiffany, got into Robinson's car, who she knew as John Osborne, and she left most of her belongings and even her car at Kathy's house because he was like, you've got to get in right now and we've got to go or this is it. And so she's like, and just like gets in the car. So later they get a call from Lisa. Robinson had told her that her family was going to try and take Tiffany away from her. And the only way to keep her would be for her to come with him. And so she calls them and she's like, why would you do that to me? Why would you take Tiffany away from me? Like, we were just there visiting and everything seemed okay. And now you want to take my child away from me? And they're like, what? No, like, we would never do that. Just come back home. Like, let's talk it out. This has been a misunderstanding or whatever. One of the last things that they heard from her on the phone was, here they come. I've got to go. And then the line disconnected. And the next morning, Kathy called the motel and was told they'd checked out. And the room had been paid for by a man named John Robinson, not John Osborne. And her heart just sank. And they never saw Lisa again.
So sad.
Also, we forgot to do a cute little thank you at the beginning. We did in part one, but I just remembered we didn't do it this time. But thank you to Mark for writing this one up. And Amber McKinney, Emily Herman, and either this Tori or another Tori requested it. So,
some kind of Tori, thank you.
Thanks to all of you, basically.
All the Tories.
Okay. Exactly. All right. So, Don and Helen, this is John's brother and sister-in-law. We hinted at this in the last episode that he duped his own brother. You are not ready for what he did. So they'd been trying to have a baby for years and they were not able to have one naturally. So they tried adoption, but they were just running into like roadblock after roadblock trying to get through all the red tape. So John had told them that he had connections in Kansas City who might be able to help. So Don and Helen meet him in Overland Park. Unbeknownst to them, the day before, John had come home with a baby and told Nancy, just take care of this baby. He didn't tell her where he got the baby. He didn't tell her anything about the baby. The child seemed like was very dirty, was cold. And so Nancy just like went into mom mode and took care of her, gave her a bath, got her warm, cleaned her up, fed her, all that kind of stuff. So back in Overland Park, Don and Helen signed what appeared to be real adoption papers and paid a $5,500 adoption fee to John. Because then he'll get it to the agency, right?
He's really good at being the go-between.
Exactly. And he's really good at forging documents, we know, too. So, like, they're looking at these papers, and they're like, these look like real adoption papers. And they've worked with other adoption agencies, right? So they've seen paperwork.
How did he do it?
And it looked legit.
This is not in a time where, like, if I would not, but if I chose to, I could Google adoption papers. And then I could be like, all right, I can come up with something that's similar, right? But he didn't. Yeah. He just had to come right out of the noodle, just had to come up with it. How did he do it? How did he do it?
Again, it's like, yeah, if he had put any of this energy into something positive for the world, what could he have done? Because, like, I'm not saying that, like, what you said, like, how did he know what it looked like? And he came up with it and it did look legit. Like, and maybe he was like, let me look at your other papers or whatever. But still, just all of those things, the manipulation and all of that, it's like incredible, but like not in a good way. It's like incredible. And like, I can't believe you put all this effort into this.
And it worked.
Just to commit fraud. And it worked. So they pay the fee, they sign all the papers or whatever. So then John takes them back to his home where Nancy presented them with Tiffany, their new daughter. And he told them that the baby's mother had died by suicide. And so they ended up naming her Heather. The same day, Kathy's husband, remember Lisa's
sister-in-law.
Sister. Mm-hmm. So this is her husband, David, showed up at the Equitoo offices and demanded to know where Lisa and Tiffany were. Robinson physically removed David from the office. At the same time, Kathy was driving to the police station and reported Lisa and Tiffany missing. When John was eventually arrested and everything he did came to light, it was determined that Heather was, in fact, Tiffany Stassi. She grew up in a loving home with Don and Helen as her parents. In 2006, Heather filed a civil suit against Truman Medical Center in Kansas City and social worker Karen Gaddis. She said that Gaddis had told Robinson about Lisa and Tiffany, which put them on his radar for his fictional home for unwed mothers of, you guys, of white babies. So when he was asking people about unwed mothers for his outreach program, he specifically said that he only wanted young, white, unwed mothers.
Shouldn't that have been a red flag?
One would think. Have you ever heard of such? Like,
no. Because you would think if he's just somebody who wants to help, I could see unwed mothers of young children or unwed mother, you know, single mothers or something. I don't know. I don't know the right terminology for it. But why does the race matter if you're just doing this out of the kindness of your heart?
Yeah, you're just trying to help people that need help. So yeah, that part shouldn't make a difference. And I understand where Heather is coming from, because the social worker and the medical center have a responsibility to verify that if you're going to give personal information out about somebody, that you need to verify that this is a legit organization.
100%. Like, you got to vet that shit. Now, again, like we talked about, John Robinson is I don't know what the hell he's doing these days, but I know that he was very, very good at persuading people, at showing the right documentation. I don't know if he convinced a lot of people. So I don't know, but I do not blame Tiffany.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Support for today's sponsor comes from Relatable. This one's for my citizen detectives out there, aka literally everyone listening to this podcast. Mm-hmm. If you love nothing more than a juicy mystery or an unsolved case, you will love Relatable's newest game, Who Killed Mia? You may know them from their internet famous party games like What Do You Meme? We love that one. Mm-hmm. Let's Get Deep and New Phone, Who Dis? So, you know, their first foray into a murder mystery game is going to be unlike anything else out there.
Who Killed Mia is a murder mystery story for the internet age, centered around the fictional but incredibly realistic influencer Mia Starr and her untimely death at the Replay Awards. Players work to solve the case using a mix of physical and immersive digital evidence, like hacking into Mia's phone, as well as gripping live-action videos to uncover the killer. This sensational game is available on the Relatable website, as well as at Target, Walmart, and Amazon. You can follow along on Instagram at Real Mia Starr and at Who Killed Mia.
This game is so fun to play, and let's be honest, it's exactly up all of our alleys. A game where you have to solve a murder? Hello.
Hello.
Getting the evidence and trying to piece everything together is such a thrill. I seriously cannot wait to get all of our friends together and play it on a super fun Saturday night. Because, I mean, come on. All we do is use our detective skills to solve crime anyway.
Calling all crime junkies. Who Killed Mia is for all our game lovers and detectives. Get this game for your next game night and find out who killed the world's first influencer in Who Killed Mia. A new kind of murder mystery game from Relatable, the creators of the hit game What Do You Meme, and get 20% off with promo code QUEENS at relatable.com/whokilledmia. Citizen detectives, it's your time to shine.
In 2007, they ended up reaching a settlement, which Heather split with her biological grandmother, Patricia. Catherine Clampett applied for a job at Equitu in 1987. She was born in Korea and was adopted by an American couple and grew up in Texas. She had a child whom she left with her family in Wichita Falls while she went to visit family in Kansas to try to find a job there. After applying at Equitu, she talked with John Robinson, and John Robinson promised Catherine that she would get all this extensive training, and then once she started working, she'd just be traveling the world for their management consulting firm. And he also promised her a brand new wardrobe, because you gotta look the part, right? Robinson put Catherine up in several different hotels near the Equitu offices. In June of 1987, Catherine left to have a meeting with Robinson and was never seen again. Her missing persons case remains open to this day. It's also just so interesting to me that, like, he's giving most of them his real name. He told Lisa Stassi John Osborne, or he's using his real initials or whatever. He know, like, if you're looking for a job and you're trying to find your new career path and like all this stuff, and you land a job, you're likely going to tell people about that, right? All of these women are telling their families, I got hired at this place. It's called Equitu. I'm going to have all this training. My boss's name is John Robinson. Like, again, he's emboldened by how many times he's just never gotten in trouble.
Exactly.
Like, how have we not put together that in all these missing persons reports, and I get different, you know, jurisdictions and all that kind of stuff, whatever. It's just frustrating because it's like, he is the common denominator. Well,
absolutely.
The last person they're seen with is John Robinson every time. Like, later in 1987, some of Robinson's fraud, embezzlement, and probation violations finally caught up with him, and he was sentenced to 4 years in prison at the Kansas Hutchinson Correctional Facility. During this time, his father passed away, and then Robinson himself suffered a series of strokes. The strokes left permanent neurological damage on the right side of his face.
Well, just permanent neurological damage and then on the right side of his face.
Oh, yes, sorry. And the right side of his face was then partially paralyzed, and it looked like, I've heard the term like slack on that side, which is not, you know, doing what it's supposed to do. After serving time in Kansas, he was transferred to two prisons in Missouri for violating probation and an old fraud charge. There's no shortage of those. While at Western Missouri Correctional Facility, he became friends with the prison librarian, Beverly Bonner. So technically, like we mentioned in episode one, Bonner and Robinson already knew each other. They had worked together like very briefly a few decades before this. Beverly was married when she worked in the prison to William Bonner. This is Dr. William Bonner, the prison doctor. While he was incarcerated, Robinson and Bonner got closer and closer, and they eventually started an affair. When he was released in January of 1994, Dr. Bonner found out about this affair, and then he and Beverly divorced. So Beverly moved to Kansas to work with Robinson at another company he had started.
Equa 17, I'm sure.
Exactly. Yeah. Dr. Bonner would occasionally receive typed letters from Beverly with her signature at the bottom. In the letters, she would, you know, say that she's traveling all over the world for work and things are going great and like all this kind of stuff. But when her son unexpectedly passed away, Dr. Bonner was shocked that Beverly did not show up. But, you know, he's like, well, she's traveling a lot. Like, maybe she wasn't able to come back on short notice or something like that. But still, it was very unlike her.
Yeah, absolutely.
To not show up for something that big.
Right.
And Beverly was getting alimony checks from her ex-husband, which were sent to her mother, and then her mother would forward them on to her. But not long after she started working with Robinson, her mother was sent a new P.O. box address to forward everything to. And of course, the checks are continuing to be cashed.
Ugh. After his release from prison, Robinson discovered the wild, wild world, wonderful world of the early internet days. He learned about chat rooms and very quickly found a home in different BDSM communities. And I don't know when the first chat room started, but I remember when we found out about chat rooms, and that was very exciting stuff. So it like changed
super exciting
everything about the internet.
Mm-hmm.
He, and we would just get into, I don't even know what kind of, like, Leonardo DiCaprio chat rooms and, God, what else? It's like very harm. Well, we thought they were harmless. Who the hell knows who we were talking to?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
We were harmless in them, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I fully believe that every guy I chatted with was a hot 16-year-old surfer guy or whatever.
Yes. Because you would say ASL and they would age, sex, location. And it's like, they, you know, who knows? But now they are completely understandably very dangerous. I mean, you don't know who you're talking to. And teenage girls specifically, hi, me, I was so naive and just took everybody at their word.
Yep.
So.
Totally.
But John, he was doing some BDSM chat rooms. Find whatever you want to do. But he went by the name Slave Master.
Blech.
Blech. And looked for women who were interested in being a submissive partner during sex. So one of the first people he met online was 45-year-old Sheila Faith. And we mentioned her earlier in last episode that Sheila had a 15-year-old daughter, Debbie, who had spina bifida. Sheila and Robinson started an online relationship during which he told her, I'm a wealthy businessman. I am a philanthropist. I wanted to say, God, what did they call it in The House Bunny? I know what they called it. And It's Always Sunny. But anyway, so that's, you know, he's really painting himself to be like this amazing stand-up guy. So Robinson offered to pay all of Debbie's medical care and give Sheila a job if she just relocated to be with him in Kansas City. Sheila and Debbie moved from Fullerton, California to Kansas City, and this was in 1994. She had all of her pension checks and any disability assistant checks moved and forwarded, and they continued to be checked or cashed, excuse me, for several years, even though Sheila and Debbie disappeared almost immediately after they got to Kansas City. Sheila's brother had received many typed letters from Sheila and became suspicious. He reached out to the Social Security Administration to look up where the checks were being cashed, but they said that they were unable to divulge any information to him due to privacy laws. In the fall of 1994, the SSA received a letter forged from Dr. William Bonner that said that Debbie was now completely disabled, and then that made her disability checks go up.
I mean, now, like, he, nobody is safe.
No.
Like, he has an affair with Dr. Bonner's wife and then is like, I need to forge a letter from a doctor. So he brings him right back into the, like, golly. Mm-hmm.
So money. Oh, my God, the greed. When Isabella Lewicka, who was 15, she and her family immigrated to the U.S. and settled in Indiana. We talked about this, talked about everybody briefly in the first episode. We're going to get more into it. So when she was 19, she was attending Purdue University and started an online BDSM relationship with Robinson. Within 9 months of the initial contact, Isabella moved away from the family home in Indiana to be near Robinson in Kansas City. where she offered herself as a permanent sex slave. She, in fact, signed a 100-plus page slave contract with Robinson. How long does it take to write a 100-page contract? What would you even put in it? Like, that's a lot.
I know, that's pretty intense. Like,
yes. How does he have so much time, dude? Like, I don't.
I mean, I guess he's not actually working ever, so.
But he's also got a full-on family. Two kids and a wife. Like, I don't. So during their time together, Isabella would proudly tell people that Robinson was her husband. And he would tell people that, hey, that's my cousin.
That just reminds me of He's Just Not That Into You, that movie where she's like, you know, I refer to the guys I go on dates with, you know, to random people like my dental hygienist, like my husband and, you know, whatever. And it's like they're introducing you as like, this is my friend.
Yeah. This you know. An acquaintance. And she's like, and there's my husband.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I mean, Isabella had reason to call him her husband because she and Robinson had acquired and filled out all of the paperwork necessary to get married. And she thought that John had turned it in and that they were married.
Mm-hmm.
And Isabella had even enrolled at a local college as Isabella Lewicka Robinson. But Robinson had not actually turned in the marriage certificate.
Mm-hmm.
Isabella often visited Robert Meyer's bookstore in Overland Park, and she had gone to the store on many occasions previously and would be considered a regular there. She and Robert would chat about the books she was purchasing, and in July of 1999, Isabella made one of her visits to the bookstore, but this time she was accompanied by Robinson, who she introduced as her husband, and John purchased some of the books for her. The pair were about to leave when Isabella mentioned to Robert that she was moving away. This was the last time Robert saw Isabella. Her parents would receive type letters from Isabella telling them of her adventures around the world, and Robinson operated a website and had a web designer who helped him set it up. When asked about Isabella, Robinson told the designer that she had been caught smoking marijuana and was deported. He always has like a quick answer.
Mm-hmm.
For everything, which is terrifying.
Yeah.
Robinson met 27-year-old Suzette Troughton in a BDSM chat room in late 1999. Suzette was a healthcare worker from Michigan, and Robinson, who went by JR to her, promised her $60,000 a year if she would take care of his diabetic, wheelchair-bound father. At this point, his dad's passed away.
That's right.
Yeah.
And that's a pretty significant salary for 1999 to be like, a home health person. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy.
In addition to the money, Robinson promised that he, Suzette, and his quote unquote father would be traveling the world together. Suzette was very tempted by the offer, but suggested that they spend some time in Kansas, meeting both JR and his father before she made that decision. In October of 1999, Suzette and JR met, and Robinson managed to persuade some colleagues to pose as various family members to entrap Suzette. At the end of the day, or at the end of the 5 days that she was in Kansas, Suzette agreed to the job offer, and in February of 2000, she moved to Kansas to begin her new life. For the next 2 weeks, Suzette rented an apartment on Robinson's credit card. He would visit regularly, explaining that he had some business deals to conclude before she could begin her new career.
What are these co-workers? What is wrong with these people?
They know that they're... Because you would think, is there a way to act like somebody is your family member without them knowing?
Right. It doesn't seem like... Because you'd have to be like... Because he needs somebody to be his father.
You would think.
Who appears sickly.
Yeah. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Wheelchair bound, which is what he's at, his words.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and I would think if the coworkers didn't know, which how could they not? But if they didn't know, right? If he just made all of this up and then maybe the conversation came up like, oh, how did you two meet or whatever? Wouldn't you think that they would be like, well, John and I met. We worked together. What? I don't know.
Exactly. Not like this is the, you know, fruit of my loins or whatever.
That's gross. But yes, exactly. Not the fruit of my looms. Right. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it just, Yeah, you're right. I don't know that there's any way that you could be like, hey, just, hey, do you want to come over and have dinner with like me and this woman? And you just tell her before they get there, before she gets there, oh yeah, my dad will be here tonight or whatever, but not tell them. Because again, he's got to have somebody who's wheelchair bound, who's, you know.
I'm thinking about like conversations that would organically come up if you were meeting somebody's family, like something like, oh, what was John like when he was a kid?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, your coworkers aren't going to fucking know that. So.
Exactly. Yeah. They'd be like, I didn't know him then, so I don't know. So you've got to have somebody who's going to go
down
with it,
plan,
right?
Yes.
Yeah. That's just awful.
It is incredible. It's terrible.
I mean, obviously they certainly didn't think that he was going to then murder her. But again,
why? Like, what is the reasoning behind what? I can't fathom if you came to me and, well, that's not fair because we are family. But a friend of mine was like, hey, can you pretend to be my sister? I'm like, why?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, but why?
Why do we need to do that? What is that? What reason could we possibly have that's not nefarious? Because that's a lie. So,
yeah. I don't have not one person in my life, I swear, I don't have one person in my life, including you and including Miss KB, that was like, hey, I have to ask you to do something and you have to agree, no questions asked. Because I am nosy. I am what we call a curious bitch. So I'm going to be like, why?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't get it.
I have had a lot of big changes in my life over the last 8 years. So having two kids, buying a house, the list goes on and on. But that got me thinking, I need to secure my future as well. Traditional estate planning can cost thousands of dollars. And one-size-fits-all templates may not capture all the important details of the life that you've built. With Trust and Will, you can protect your legacy from the comfort of your home, starting at just $159.
So I don't think it's a secret at this point that I watch garbage TV.
What?
I know, I do. Just trash, trash, and more trash. And I know it, and I love it. But one guy on one of the shows that I love has a very famous celebrity godfather, and when this celebrity godfather passed away, no one knew who was getting what from his estate. And that's scary to think about because we don't want to be in a situation where people are fighting over money when the focus should be on grieving the loss. And that's one factor that Trust and Will can help with.
Trust and Will has simplified the process of creating and managing your will or trust online, from finding out what's right for your family to finalizing documents with a notary. Each will or trust is crafted to be state-specific and customized to your specific needs. For example, care wishes, nominating guardians, final arrangements, and power of attorney. And they can help loved ones avoid lengthy and expensive legal proceedings or having the state decide what happens to your assets. Trust and Will has earned an overall rating of excellent with thousands of five-star reviews on Trustpilot. Hundreds of thousands of families and counting have used their expertise for estate planning.
Gain peace of mind today with Trust and Will. Get 10% off plus free shipping of your estate plan documents by visiting trustandwill.com/queens. That's 10% off and free shipping at trustandwill.com/queens. So the pair had regular sex, taking photographs of the moments, which Suzette would email to online friends who were also into BDSM. The emails would continue long after March 1st when Suzette disappeared, but mostly without photos. Wonder why. The extent of the emails suddenly changed after that date. Suzette no longer talked about past relationships, friendships, events in her life. All correspondents would talk about how great her life is, how happy her boss and new slave master made her. And all of the emails were signed Suze, S-U-Z, a nickname that she absolutely had never used before this.
Oh my gosh. Like, just all of a sudden, it's like, pictures are gone. And
we're
it's
not talking
only
about any past memories that I have that you would know about.
Yeah. It's just, oh, I'm having a great time. Everything's great. Everything's great. Everything's great. I love this guy. He treats me so good. Like, whatever. And then she's like, XOXO, Suze. And everybody's like, I've never called you that. You've never been called that by anybody. Why would you start signing emails that way?
Yeah. If you started doing that, and if we only communicated through, I don't know, text nowadays, right? You might email me. I don't know. But if you started doing that and then you were like, okay, well, everything's great. I'm not going to talk about anything that I normally talk about, like my kids, my, I don't know, clothes that you want to buy, which is something we talk about a lot.
A lot.
Well, and it goes both ways. But if you stopped talking about that kind of stuff and you were like XOXO Ty, I'd be like, you must have been abducted by a tall gray or this ain't you.
Exactly. Yeah. Red Nobody flags, calls you that. Yeah.
Yeah. Suzette's mother, Carolyn, also received several letters from Suzette, supposedly from all over the world while she was traveling. But guess what? They were all postmarked from Kansas City.
I mean, Carolyn ain't no dummy.
Ew.
I would not have paid attention to that. Like where it's postmarked from.
Well, you might after you read some of the letters and were like, this seems odd.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I guess that's true. But yeah, she ain't playing around. She's like, this isn't adding up.
You might do some Harriet the Spy-in after you were like, this does not sound like.
That's true.
So-and-so. But another thing about the letters, they were written with mistake-free spelling and grammar. And that's something that Suzette was not known for. Carolyn said that her daughter was a terrible speller and she would never type a note to friends or family. It would be handwritten.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, that would be like getting letters from my husband and him spelling words correctly and me being able to understand what words he's trying to say.
And not spelled phonetically, if that. I don't mm-hmm. even know if that's yeah. even.
Like.
Right.
Yeah. I would be like, who's got you? That's not.
Exactly.
You don't know how to spell this word.
Right. You know, obviously, your mother, your husband, your spouse, whoever, you're going to know them well enough to be like, that does not sound mm-hmm. like the whoever that I know.
Yeah.
After not hearing from her daughter for a while, Carolyn called the phone numbers that Suzette had given her, something that Robinson didn't know that Suzette had done.
Mm-hmm.
Carolyn was shocked when Robinson answered one phone call, because in all the letters that she had received from her daughter, she and John were supposed to be traveling together.
How is he just right there available in town?
Right. When she talked to him, he told her, don't worry, I'm not traveling with her right now. The thing is, Suzette actually stole a bunch of money from me and she left with one of my friends. So that's what happened there.
Mm-hmm. I was traveling with her, but after she did me wrong, now I'm not. That's why I'm here to answer this phone call.
I am a stand-up guy. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I don't steal money, but you guess what? Your daughter did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
The fucking nerve of this guy. So after that, Carolyn called the police and filed a missing persons report. And good on Carolyn for trusting her gut.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, unbeknownst to John Robinson, he was the center of an investigation that would end with him being arrested in June of 2000. Over the years, he'd become more and more comfortable, which led him to being more and more careless, like we discussed. He had the attention of investigators in Kansas and Missouri, and his name was constantly showing up in missing persons cases. Robinson met a woman named Vicky. She had been a psychiatrist, but was laid off a month before she met JR on a BDSM website. She was looking for someone to help financially support her, and Robinson told her that he was a member of a group of, quote, elite dominance, and he would be able to support her. And this impressed Vicky. And when she asked if he could help her find a job, he was like, oh my gosh, of course. So, yeah. I can get you anything you need, basically. So she was in Texas. So John actually wired her $100 to make the trip to Kansas City. So she traveled 700 miles, hoping to meet Robinson that day because she went there for that. And he's like, I cannot even meet with you today. I'm very busy. So he puts her up in an extended stay hotel. What they did not know was that the police knew that he liked to use this hotel specifically. So they, like, he always booked room 120. That was his deal. He always booked the same room when he paid for someone to stay there. So they booked the adjoining room and waited.
Fall is coming. Then winter, of course. I know the saying, but you know, I've watched Game of Thrones, guys. I know, but seriously, it's going to be fall, y'all.
Cannot wait.
I know. And oh my gourd. HelloFresh has you covered with meal planning and shopping to deliver everything you need to cook up a tasty meal right at home. They do the hard part and you get to take the credit. It's a meal kit with purpose.
Ever wish you can spend less time planning, shopping, and cooking for the family and spend more time with them? I know nobody has ever thought of that before because everybody loves meal planning.
Right.
Just kidding. You've got easy, time-saving breakfast and family dinners to kid-approved lunches and snacks. HelloFresh has what it takes to keep everyone, including you, happy and satisfied. Mm-hmm. HelloFresh takes the stress out of mealtime by delivering fresh ingredients and easy recipes right to your door. This fall, skip that extra trip to the grocery store and have dinner ready in no time with America's number one meal kit. You can choose from 40 weekly recipes, and they have some amazing fall meals to choose from. You can also stock up on easy breakfasts, yummy quick lunches, and snacks. When you get HelloFresh, you know you're getting top-notch produce since it travels from the farm to your door in less than 7 days. That's incredible, it is. Honestly. I can't tell you how many times we've bought produce at the grocery store, got it home, and it's gone bad before we use it.
Well,
not with HelloFresh.
I know.
Absolutely not. HelloFresh is the bomb. My entire family, including my two picky children, have literally loved every single meal we have made for them. We might substitute like a sauce or ketchup or ranch or whatever because ranch is life, okay, and they'll actually eat it, but they love these meals.
So if you're ready to start drooling uncontrollably, go to HelloFresh.com/50KillerQueens and use code 50KillerQueens for 50% off plus 15% off the next 2 months. Again, go to HelloFresh.com/50KillerQueens and use code 50KillerQueens for 50% off plus 15% off the next 2 months. America's number one meal kit.
So Robinson showed up the second day about an hour later than he had told Vicky he would. Because what's she going to do about that? Who cares? He immediately tried to get her to sign a slave contract, which she was hesitant to do. But eventually she did sign after some revisions, particularly a part that said if their relationship ended, that Robinson couldn't just like kick her out on the streets. John immediately undressed and told her to do the same. They needed to see if they had sexual chemistry together. And this did not last long. He got dressed and ready to leave. But before he did, he opened a bag full of sex toys and told her to have a look at them. The next day, he returned and asked if she liked anything from the bag. Again, while he's getting undressed, he told her to put on a pair of spiked heels. And she was like, I'm not really comfortable with all of this. I'm going to keep my clothes on. Well, of course,
that's just awkward.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely awkward. And this pisses him off to no end. And Vicky starts to get pretty scared. Robinson began to remove her clothes. Anyway, he slapped a leather collar around her neck, handcuffed her, and started taking pictures of her.
I wonder if this was in the contract, because that doesn't seem right.
Right? When she threatened to leave and go back to Texas, he stopped and they had an argument and then he left. Later, Vicky called and apologized to him, and the next day he returned. Again, this man is so manipulative. Like, he assaulted her. He held her down, took her clothes off, took pictures of her, handcuffed her, and she apologizes to him.
And the thing is, now, I don't know a lot about the BDSM culture. I really don't. But I do know, from what I gather, and I feel like this is a fact, or if it's not, it should be. I don't see why it wouldn't be. Consent. So whatever you've got going on, yes, it has to be, I would think, and hope, and also am pretty sure that it is, it's driven out of respect, consent,
safety.
You know, like, yes, communicating with each other, is this okay? We understand each other. Like, that's, so, and for her to feel... It's just so sad. She felt like she needed to apologize to him.
Yep. Yeah. And that's something that, like, we Did we ever cover the House of Hammer documentary? I forget now if we did that.
No, we didn't. We never did.
We both watched it though, right?
Oh, yes, we did.
So Armie Hammer was very big on the BDSM stuff too.
But bondage specifically, right?
Yes. But he took advantage of women who did not necessarily, like, they weren't already familiar with it like he was. So he would basically try to tell them, this is just part of it. This is just how it works, right? And then
it doesn't feel right to you because you're not familiar with it, but I am. So
exactly. This is just how it works. And if you want to please me, this is what you've got to do or whatever. And of course, like after those relationships have ended, they now know that safety, consent, all of those things are
trust,
at the core
understanding,
yeah,
yes,
of BDSM. Like it's supposed to be a mutual enjoyment. If one person is not enjoying it, then it stops.
Mm-hmm.
And Vicky was actually familiar with it. But again, he is completely manipulative. He completely grooms these women to just believe everything he tells them and to rely completely on them. So they all are on him. So they also feel like, well, if I wanted to say something, I couldn't anyway, because he's where my job is coming from. He's where my place to stay is coming from.
Well, he's isolated these women. He never keeps them in the place that they are from.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And then, like, even with Lisa Stassi, he was like, yeah, and your family is trying to hurt you by taking your child away. You can't trust them. I will save you. You've got to get away from there.
Disgusting.
Disgusting. So Vicky called to apologize to him. He comes back the next day. While she was giving him oral sex, he reached back and slapped her harder than she'd ever been slapped. Out of nowhere. They argued about this, but afterwards kind of seemed to be fine. In fact, they made plans for her to go to Texas and pick up all her stuff and then permanently move to Kansas City. When he left, though, he grabbed a bag of sex toys that belonged to Vicky. And these were estimated to be between $500 and $700 worth of toys in this bag.
Damn. That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. Robinson left with the bag, and on his way out, he throws the contract that she had signed in the trash.
Okay.
Vicky goes back to Texas. She waits for John Robinson to call her about the van that he said he would get for her to move. He never called. So she started calling him, and she called him several times, and he would do everything he could to dodge her calls. Finally, she was ready to move on from him, and she was like, okay, well, if we're not doing this, if this is not happening, you need to give me back the big bag of sex toys that you stole from me, because that was worth a lot of money. And if he didn't return them, she said, I'm going to go to the police. And so Robinson was like, oh, yeah? Well, if you don't stop bothering me about the toys, then I'll turn you in to the Texas Board of Psychologists and send them all the pictures I took of you.
Flaming bag.
Yes.
Dog duty. Mm-hmm. Like, he has just the biggest disgust I've ever heard of in my entire life.
Yeah. Because it should not matter to the board, you know, the governing board of her occupation, what type of sexual fantasy she's acting out with two consenting adults, you know, like between two consenting adults. Like,
right. That should not matter. However, and I think that obviously, like, I don't think this is the point that you're trying to make. Like, well, they're consenting adults, which that should not matter. Like, whatever I think, you know what? Like, whatever you do in your free time, not hurt anybody, everybody's cool with it, do it.
Right.
Do it. This was not consent, though. The pictures. She did not say you could take them anyway.
Exactly. Yeah.
And now he's blackmailing her. Ooh.
Exactly. Yeah. So she did back off for a little while, but eventually she did go to the police, which is a huge risk for her, right? Like,
oh, yeah.
That's really brave. In May of 2000, another woman made arrangements with Robinson to stay in room 120. They had the same arrangement as he did with Vicky and met in the same way via an online ad. I wonder why he chose the same room every time. Did he have it, like, wired up, like, bugged? Was he recording them when they weren't there? Like, you know?
I don't know.
Because the same room every single time. I don't know.
Well, I mean, I'm seeing a lot of creatures of habit behaviors with him.
It's well, that's true. Texas. Yeah.
It's always Equa something. It's always room 120. It's always.
That's true. So the day after she arrived, Robinson went to the motel to meet her. And when she wasn't waiting naked on her knees when he walked in, he beat her severely. And then they had sex. And then he left immediately after. When he came back a few days later, he told her to give him her social security card and told her to close all her bank accounts because she would be moving to Kansas City soon. And she was terrified. I mean, this is somebody who had just beaten her for just not waiting for him in the way that he wanted her to wait for him. You know, what's he going to do if I don't follow his instructions?
Absolutely. So it's either he manipulates them and with charisma and, you know, I don't even know what else, love bombing, like that kind of stuff, or fear. He intimidates them. So
exactly. So she did what he told her to do. Again, Robinson abused her, taking pictures of the damage that he caused. And he would say he had sex. This sounds like rape to me, but.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. He left immediately after again, and she realized this is just going to keep getting worse and worse. So she went to the lobby and she asked for help. And detectives talked to her. They put her in a safe house and seemed like, okay, this is the time to make a move and arrest him. But the district attorney knew about Robinson's history and how he had just slipped through the cracks time and time again.
I'll be honest with you. When I hear about this the first time, I was like, you got to be fucking kidding me. Like, just arrest him. Yeah. But I'm glad that they didn't at that time. I also want to point out the amazing courage of these women.
Yes. Yeah. Because that is scary and you don't know what's going to happen. And he has.
And who knows what would have happened had they not.
Exactly. And he has them so reliant upon him that they're giving up a lot of security, like financial and otherwise, to do this, to get away from it. I mean, that is so scary. So at this point, the DA wants a rock solid case, like no way to lose it, slam dunk. Toward the end of May, they learned that Robinson had met a 17-year-old who had recently given birth and was living in her car. So he promised her that if she became his mistress, he would take care of her and her baby. On June 1st, 2000, the district attorney drew up everything for an arrest warrant. The next day, at 10 a.m., nearly a dozen unmarked cars quietly surrounded the farm that Robinson owned near Lacine, Kansas. One detail that helped investigators get the warrants to search his property was that theft of the bag of sex toys. You know, because they're like, we've just got to try to hold him on whatever we can hold him on. Like, and the theft helped them do that. On his farm, they discovered two 85-pound barrels, which were sealed. And when they opened them, they found the decomposing bodies of two women. They were later identified as Isabella Lewicka and Suzette Troughton. Across the state line in Missouri, Robinson rented two storage units at a storage facility, and those were searched, and three similar drums were found. And there were bodies in them, later identified as Beverly Bonner, Sheila Faith, and Debbie Faith. All five women were determined to have been killed in the same way, with a blunt force object to the back of the head. In the subsequent trials in both Kansas and Missouri, Robinson was found guilty of murder and several lesser charges. In Kansas, he was given the death penalty plus life. The life sentence came in Lisa Stassi's case because she was killed before the state had reinstated the death penalty. After his Kansas convictions, Robinson faced murder charges in Missouri based on the evidence discovered in that state. Missouri aggressively pursued capital punishment convictions, so Robinson's attorneys were like, we've got to avoid a trial here. The Missouri prosecutor insisted as a condition of any plea bargain that Robinson would lead the authorities to the bodies of Stassi, Godfrey, and Clampett. Robinson, who has literally never cooperated with an investigator, completely refused. However, the DA was facing some pressure to make a deal because his case technically wasn't airtight. This was not a slam dunk necessarily. Among other issues, there was no unequivocal evidence that any of the murders had been committed within his jurisdiction, which is such like a red tape thing to be like, well, he might get away with it because technically this isn't my jurisdiction. I don't know. Like, you know,
yeah.
Robinson, on the other hand, was feeling pressure to plead guilty to avoid an almost certain death sentence in Missouri. And failing that, another capital murder trial back in Kansas. So eventually they realized Robinson's just never going to cooperate. We're not going to find these women's bodies because of his help. So a compromise was reached. Robinson acknowledged that they had enough evidence to prosecute him for capital murder, which was an admission of guilt. His statement lacked any type of remorse or accountability, of course. He received a life sentence for each murder he was charged with in Missouri. In November of 2015, the Kansas Supreme Court vacated the convictions for Suzette Troughton and Lisa Stassi because, quote, prosecutors at the time improperly used the murders of the same four previous victims to support each capital murder charge. The court found that in showing that Robinson killed more than one person as part of the same common scheme, Johnson County prosecutors used the same killings to support each of the capital murder charges. So that created a situation where Robinson was like technically unconstitutionally tried twice for the same crime.
Can't roll my eyes.
I know.
Enough. Like,
which the court explained in a 415-page decision.
Whoa.
They did uphold the conviction for Isabella Lewicka and the accompanying death sentence. In 2005, Nancy Robinson filed for divorce, citing incompatibility and irreconcilable differences, which I suppose being a serial killer isn't an irreconcilable difference.
I just wonder, I'm sure it has something to do with, or allegedly had something to do with his manipulation of her.
Yeah.
But it took quite a while for Nancy to be like, I know, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And maybe he was telling her through this whole thing, they don't have anything on me. They've got the wrong guy. I'm being framed. You know,
oh, I'm
I don't
sure.
know. Yeah, exactly.
He probably drew up his own evidence.
Yeah, exactly. There's Exhibit a letter a. from the killer. Yeah,
yes.
Exactly. Like, oh, gosh. John Robinson remains on death row at the El Dorado Correctional Facility in Kansas. And that's the end of that.
I fucking hate this guy. I hate him with every fiber of my being. It's just, it's so, I don't know the right word. It's disgusting, but it's also laughable in a way when serial kill, any killer, let's just go with that. Don't have to be a serial killer. Any killer is like, oh, no, I don't want to die.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No. I'll do anything not to die.
Yeah, I'll do anything. You certainly didn't give that choice to any of your victims.
No.
And killed them for, you know, checks.
A couple hundred dollars a week, a month.
Exactly. It's not like, are you serious? And then killing Lisa to take her baby to get a $5,500 check? He sold a human being. Like, oh my gosh.
To his brother. And you know what? To anyone. Awful. God awful. You should never. That, of course, should not happen. But I have a hard time believing that his brother, like Don, after that is like, well, you know, we can get past this.
Right. Yeah.
We'll just be brothers after this. Like, I don't know. But I would definitely be like, you know what? A fuck you, and you're dead to me forever. You're
totally dead to me. Like, this is my child that I believed I adopted through
an actual agency,
the proper
that you
channels. Yeah,
I trusted you.
Like, I have now, unbeknownst to me, engaged in human trafficking. How could you do that? How could you do that to the child? How could you do that to your brother? Like, you know?
But clearly, John Robinson is very much from Zoolander. Like, it doesn't matter who you step on or leave dead and bloodied along the way. Like, that's John Robinson.
Yeah, 100%. Exactly. He just has no
There's no moral compass given. There.
Yeah. And obviously, if you did that to anybody, it would be wrong. But just like that added layer of like, dude, that's your brother.
Yeah. Like, I don't care if he stole your lunchbox when y'all were 12. Like, that, you know, like what the, what, I just, that's, he is so, he's such a disgust. I don't have any, like, bags of trashes. It's just.
Dirty, brown, water trash.
Absolutely. But guys, that's it. That's the case.
That's the case. So let us know what you think. And, you know, we'll catch you on the next episode.
Yes, we will. We love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation.
Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye.
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud. Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.